That was beautiful. And a beautiful song for God to hear as we worship Him today here on His Sabbath. So I'm going to start with a question for you. Where is the first time that the word that in the English language, rejoice, in the English Bibles, where is the first time that the word rejoice appears in the Bible? The answer is in Leviticus 23:40, when it describes people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Leviticus 23, verse 40. And it says, "And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord or the Eternal, your God, for 7 days." So it says, "You shall rejoice," a command to rejoice. Other uses of rejoice related to the Feast of Tabernacles show it to be a time that is, as I said, a commanded rejoicing. It was commanded to ancient Israel, and later it was commanded to the Jews who escaped after captivity and came back to Jerusalem. And later it was kept and commanded to be done by the New Testament Church of God. So basically, it's been a command to keep all of God's annual holy days, as well as the weekly Sabbath, for the church for the last nearly 2,000 years, including the Feast of Tabernacles. In 1979, I observed the Feast of Tabernacles in Israel. While there, I visited the Western Wall, they call it, and I noticed behind me a tent filled with Jewish people celebrating what they call Sukkoth, which means booths or tents. And from within that tent, I wish I had a video of this. From within this tent was emanating laughter. You could hear that people were eating a lot of food and eating and drinking. There was loud celebratory music going on, blasting out of that tent, very close to the Western Wall. And like I said, I could hear the people laughing and talking and feasting. And to the beat of the music, there was a gentleman who was sitting on a chair near the entrance to the tent. He was right near the tent. And he was really in sync with the music. And he had a cane, and the cane was bulging the tent in rhythm with the music. And I wish I had a video, but just picture it in your mind. They were taking it seriously to rejoice at the Feast of Tabernacles. Observant Jews have been keeping the Feast of Tabernacles way longer than 2,000 years, longer than the Church of God, the New Testament Church of God. And Sukkoth is, they also call it Zaman Sechatinu, or something approaching that, which means season of our rejoicing. So that's a phrase they use to describe the Feast of Tabernacles, or they have a phrase, the time of our joy. And this observance has been a time of both agricultural thanksgiving, the harvest, the fall harvest season in their area, remembrance of Israelites and their 40-year journey through the desert. And from the internet, you can glean that the commandment to rejoice during Sukkot is emphasized throughout the Torah as a festival, as the festival is seen as a time of spiritual clarity, community unity, and celebrating the joy that comes from receiving God's love and his blessings. And you could say the exact same about us in the Church of God, in the New Testament Church of God. Also note that an ancient Jewish tradition has been to read for a very, very, very long time. The tradition has been to read the book of Ecclesiastes during the Feast of Tabernacles observance. Although the book of Ecclesiastes has been considered by many, you hear this sometimes, some people refer to the book of Ecclesiastes as a negative or pessimistic book. I submit to you, and it will submit to you in this message, that it is actually a very positive book that exhorts us to be what one of our elders in a sermon I listened to called a sober rejoicing. A definitely a rejoicing, but a sober rejoicing, because remember there's the other command about keeping God's feasts, such as the Feast of Tabernacles, is to have a reverential fear. Not just a rejoicing, but a reverential fear. So if you combine them together, the elder came up with a phrase which I thought was very, very concise, a sober rejoicing. And so the book of Ecclesiastes is a perfect complement to the commanded rejoicing of the Feast of Tabernacles, and I will strive to show you that. And it is perfect preparation for us in the church at such a time as this to come back charged, looking forward, as was mentioned in the sermonette, to the time between now and the spring holiday season, a time of doing God's work individually and as a church. And to do this at a time which, if Winston Churchill was here, speaking to you right now, he might refer to as the gathering storm, as we see what's happening in the world during these challenging times. We have been given a perfect preparation through the Feast of Tabernacles and Eighth Day, and the fact that the words of Ecclesiastes also are associated with the feast. So the purpose of this message is to present the case that the theme of the Feast of Tabernacles and the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes, the sober rejoicing before God, that theme is in perfect harmony between the two, and they both prepare us to go forward to do the work that God has given us to do. The body of this message that I'm going to present to you has been drawn mainly from information that I learned from a sermon given back in 2016 by Mr. Bob Dick. a sermon that was entitled Ecclesiastes, Is It a Pessimistic Book? That was the title of his sermon. And it was so interesting and so well substantiated what he was saying that I wanted to share it with you in case you had not heard that sermon that he gave. So I want to give first a few short introductory comments about the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a substantial 12-chapter book with a lot to say. It is the last poetic wisdom book within what's called the writings of the Old Testament. It is the fourth of what the Jewish people call the five megaloth, festival scrolls. It is a book which deals with somber reflection and with joy. The name of the book is derived from the first verse, which in many English translations begins with the words of the preacher. So that word that the Jewish people use to in naming the book of Ecclesiastes refers to one who has gathered people to preach to them and probably was something that we believe King Solomon did when he gave these words to Israel. And this book contrasts the temporary with the permanent, in other words, the temporary physical with the eternal spiritual. So those are just a few words that I gleaned from reading what people had to say about the book that before digging right into the words of Ecclesiastes right now. So, first, I want to address a common misconception about the book of Ecclesiastes by going to, and most the first part of this will be mainly will be in the book of Ecclesiastes. If we go to the very beginning of Ecclesiastes, which is, get it right here. Yes. Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 through 2. I just want to read those. Very famous. Because this verse has been misunderstood. These two verses have been misunderstood by many. It says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, so that's why we believe this was King Solomon. And in the translation of the New King James, English translation, it says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So when you read those words, our instinct tells us that those words are out of character with what I just told you is the commanded rejoicing that God has commanded us during the Feast of Tabernacles. So why would the Jewish people want to read a book that at first glance one might assume is pessimistic by the first two verses? So the instincts we have when we read those two verses, we have been groomed into thinking by our perceptions. The first of those perceptions comes from these words. Well, vanity is not a good quality. in general, the pride and the vanity being puffed up. The only problem is those weren't Solomon's words. Those were the words of an English, of many of the English translations that translated it that. But the Hebrew word that was translated, that has been translated vanity, actually means vapor, a vapor. And many English translations do correctly translate that in verse 2. For instance, one translation I have says, "Vapor of vapors, vapor of vapors," says the preacher. All is vapor. And what is vapor? Vapor is something temporary. You see, and then it evaporates and disappears. Vapor of vapors and futility of futility, says the preacher. Vapor of vapors and futility of futilities. All is vanity, emptiness, falsity, and vainglory. Solomon simply started his book by saying that life was a vapor. It was not permanent. And it was in the context of the following verse 3, which establishes the framework which will be built on throughout the book. And that is verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That's the question that's asked. What does all your toil, your work, accomplish in your life? Commentaries say, and then of course, what I just read to you at the end of verse 3, notice it has a phrase, under the sun. So what does under the sun mean? What does that mean? Well, if you look at some of the good commentaries, they say that under the sun means as opposed to the future world. Solomon is telling the reader in this Ecclesiastes introduction that in this human life, in this time period, in this under the sun world that we live in, all the things that you can observe, see, ponder, think about, discuss, are but a vapor. All of your activities in your life, the work you do, all of those things are a short passing vapor. So I worked for 52 years for a company. I never thought I'd work that long at the company, but I did. And when it came time to leave, I had a lot of documents I had to shred that I had to destroy upon leaving the company. And I did that. I went to a ju big, humongous shredder. And while I was in the process of shredding those files, I was thinking, in fact, it was sort of hurt me. I did a lot of work on some of those drawings. It sort of hurt to do that. But the thoughts flashed in my mind of the temporariness of our physical pursuits in this life. It didn't take that long to shred 52 years worth of documents. And so that's what he was saying there in that verse that I just read to you. And so King Solomon was a brilliant man. He had all more money than he needed, more wealth than he needed, and gold and silver. And like I said, he was brilliant. He had a scientific mind, and he used that scientific mind to observe all of man's efforts under the sun. So he actually made this a research project to try to determine what is this all about? What is this life all about? So in verse 3, which I guess maybe I did not yet read to you. Yes, I did. Yes, I read that to you, but I'm going to. Oh, no, excuse me. I'm jumping to chapter 2, verse 3. That's what I meant to say. I'm jumping to chapter 2, verse 3. And that was Solomon's scientific experiments about finding purpose in life. And it says in Ecclesiastes 2:3 in the New King James, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. So he wanted to enjoy a lot of wine, but still keep enough wits about him to analyze what was happening to him. And I wanted to learn how to lay hold on folly. He wanted to hear from the great comedians. He could have try to make them laugh. Till I might see what good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. What is a good course of action while we're alive? What should we should be doing? And then he, the book of Ecclesiastes is organized in many different ways, and different commentaries organize it differently. But one way which Mr. Bob Dick used is the structure of the book that I'm going to follow in this message, which he followed. And that is dividing the book, which is 12 chapters, into six sections and summarizing those sections. So the first section to analyze here is Ecclesiastes 2, 26, 24, excuse me, through 26. So starting with Ezekiel 2, 24. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? He had all the money to eat and drink and do anything he wanted. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give it to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So that's another phrase, grasping for the wind. Solomon had examined what value comes from striving for wisdom and what lasting happiness comes from being an Epicurean and just pleasing yourself with all kinds of gourmet food and drink and doing great accomplishments, like in Solomon's example, building the temple in Jerusalem, among many other things that he built, great and gardens and various things. So great, you and I can do something great can accomplish something great. And it's to use a pun, great. But then, okay, what's after that? What's next? If I have a great meal and enjoy a wonderful meal, that's wonderful. God wants us to. But then after a while, you say, what's next for dinner? We still want more. So what is the purpose of doing this? The people who achieve them are forgotten. In fact, they are so forgotten that they are never known. So Solomon talked about wisdom for wisdom's sake, getting wisdom, just wisdom like the Greek philosophers. And what is great about getting pleasure? What is the be all and end all of accomplishments or things that are pleasurable? Solomon said, "Who can learn more about whether pleasure comes from food and drink more than I, because I have more than anyone else." So if you look at what he said here as the conclusion to this first section, to the first part of his experiment, these six sections, his conclusion was, this is what God gives to mankind. And what is that gift that has more durability than big bankrolls, names on plaques, statues, the breaking of records, world records, etc.? That a man or a woman should enjoy the work that they do, and subsequently that they should enjoy what is produced, what we refer to simply as the fruit of one's labor. And certainly it is a great blessing. If you have a job you love, that is a great blessing to enjoy what you're doing. But is that all there is to our physical lives, our temporary physical lives? So that's the first section of Solomon's experiments. The second one is now jumping to is Ecclesiastes 3, 9 through 13. And the this section, second section, is when God has given us a task to do. Ecclesiastes 3, 9 through 13. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are occupied, and the talents they have been given to do those tasks. I'll add, he has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has put eternity in their hearts. And my dad, who was not in the church, would sometimes say to me, what is, he would say, wonder about what is in store for us for eternity. I did my best to try to tell him, but he still wondered about it. So he has put eternity in their hearts, except no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. We don't know all the things that our great, almighty, all-knowing God is doing, but he has told us, he has given us enough so we know what his plan is. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is a gift of God. That is essentially the lesson of the Feast of Tabernacles. What more perfect of a book could there be for what we are told to do by God in rejoicing at the feast than to read words like this? To eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. So Solomon is saying, rejoice. He adds, do good to men. Eat and drink. Enjoy the good of your labor. So that's number two, section two of Solomon's scientific experiment. Section three is an observation of the vanity, the temporariness of gaining honor. Even though it's wonderful to be honored on your job, with a promotion, it's wonderful. It's a blessing. But it is not eternal. Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20 now. Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him. And every day is a gift we have is a gift from God. For it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. He is given things to do in his life. We are given those things. Wealth comes and goes quickly, though. When somebody goes into life saying, my goal is to make money, and that's my only goal, you'll find men of wisdom who will look at somebody and they will say, let me redirect your thinking process. That not be the only goal in your life. Find something that you truly love to do and do it with passion. And a lot of times, if you do that, money will follow. If you really get a job you love, that will be a byproduct of it. But just having a goal of getting money is a temporary, non-permanent pursuit in our lives. The fourth section of Solomon's experiment was eating, drinking, and being happy. I didn't see being married, getting married. I'm not talking about what Paul said, eat, drink, and be merry, as of drinking too much alcohol. But I'm saying enjoying good food and drink and being happy in the right way. Okay. Now the King James Version gives you the old concept that I said. Then I commended mirth, because a man has no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and be merry. And you think of a parties with all kinds of food and drink and all that. For that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun. But that's not, it's really not talking about overindulgence. It's talking about enjoying good food and drink and happiness as you're doing that enjoyment with others, possibly, as you do that. But that's temporary also. The fifth section is Now we're getting to something in Ecclesiastes 9, 7 through 10. And as I tell you this one, be reminded that this was to be read during people's keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles. Starting in Ecclesiastes 9, verses 7 through 10, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, symbolic of righteousness. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife of your whom you love all the days of your life, of your vain life, in other words, your temporary life. All the days of your vaporous life, in other words, or temporary, which he has given you under the sun, all the days of vapor. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. So when the ancient Israelites were keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, picture them going on their pilgrimage up to Jerusalem and reading these words and thinking of these words. And Solomon adds another element. Eat your bread, drink your wine, enjoy it with a happy heart. Do a pilgrimage to the feast. And for us locally, when we keep the feast, we can do the same thing. And it truly, there's nothing like the Feast of Tabernacles, really, in the world. If you look at other pagan-derived days and all, nothing is satisfying as God's annual holy days. And I think we've all experienced that, who've been able to go to the feast with surrounded by brethren of the like mind, with the same goal in life of the kingdom of God, and going out to meals or eating at one's home there, and the fellowship, there's nothing like it. It's beautiful. And the conversations. I went to the Philippines one year in 1983, and a man who lived in Baguio City invited me for lunch there. And it was like we had known each other all our life, and yet we just met each other. And we already had that bond of the church and the plan of salvation. And there were several other guys, and it was like we had known each other all our lives. Now we're coming to the final, the sixth section of Solomon's experiment in Ecclesiastes 12, 13 through 14. And this section can be summarized as fear God and keep his commandments. That's the conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes. It says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. Or some say the whole duty of man, but it means it's really man's all, as the New King James says it. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is the grand summary The preacher who identified himself as the king wanted us to know at the end of the book that all of his scientific observation and study had not changed his conclusion one iota from the beginning to the end of his writings of this book. Because the very same thing he said in Ecclesiastes 1:2, he ended the whole book with in Ecclesiastes 12:8, vanity of vanities, or really vapor of vapors, all is vapor, all is temporary. So going to ask you two questions. We finished going through that. Is Ecclesiastes a pessimistic book after what I've just read to you? Well, did I say anything in the book that was pessimistic? I don't think I did. The author defined his field, his research, his own human life, experimenting with his own life, this material, physical life he had, and during his quote-unquote under the sun period. So he said, this is my subject, this is what I've researched, and he tells the individual reading the book, find something you love to do and do it, and when it produces something, sit down and savor what is produced. Isn't that what we're told to do during the Feast of Tabernacles? How beautifully this book fits into the Feast of Tabernacles, the Sukkot, as the Jews would call it. Okay, question two. Is Ecclesiastes out of character for the Feast of Tabernacles? So there's two reasons the answer is no. Reason number one. It tells us to rejoice. While in the New Testament Church of God, while we in the New Testament Church of God don't call the Feast of Tabernacles the time of our rejoicing or the time of our joy or the season of our rejoicing, it is still the greatest time of rejoicing in the entire year for us. So to answer the question, does it fit within the Feast of Tabernacles theme? Recall those six sections that I mentioned, and also keep in mind that if we truly, dutifully keep second tithe, we are saving all year 10% of our money to spend in 1 week of the whole money, 52 weeks worth of earnings we save so we can spend it to rejoice for one of those 52 weeks. God said, take the bounty of the fruit of your labor to the feast, and if you can't take, your oxen to the feast or whatever, turn it into cash and go and bestow it on whatever your heart desires, food, beverage, activities with family and friends, and rejoice before me. Come before me smiling and with joy, God is telling us, and use the bounty of your 50, I'll say the other 51 weeks of your labor. So I'm going to tell you another story, which I will never forget as long as I live. I will never forget this. It was either my first or second Feast of Tabernacles. It was in Long Beach, The first two Feast of Tabernacles I kept was in Long Beach, California. And there was a wonderful man from our San Francisco area who is since deceased. And I'm going to give you just a synopsis of his life. He was a praying, a prayer warrior. He was a man of great compassion and love for others. He was extremely poor and barely able to exist, to survive. And I remember taking him one day, a Sunday, I think, so he could find a place that he could live. And he had jobs, and there's nothing wrong with those jobs, but he struggled to be a mail carrier downtown in San Francisco, and everything. He struggled for employment and had a very low income. So he and me and another guy at the feast went to a restaurant, and we roll in to valet parking. And as we get out of the car, you would have thought, his name was Bob, you would have thought he was a bank tycoon. And the valet was there. And I knew, because I knew all of his background and all of his struggles just to survive. And he takes a wad of money out and gives it to that valet. And the valet says, "Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir." Not knowing anything about his life, Bob's life. And that scene in my mind, that video in my mind, I will never lose for the rest of my life. About a man rejoicing with the bounty he did have, and sharing it and blessing others. So that's reason number one. Just considering second time that God has designed for us so we can rejoice. Reason number two is when Solomon began by saying, "Vapor of vapors," says the preacher, "Vapor of vapors, all is vapor." The fall holy days really go by fast when you're keeping them. Even trumpets, atonement, tabernacles in the eighth day point out to us that this human world and its societies have no lasting, the world used, and we are told by Christ to pray, "Thy kingdom come," because the world desperately needs that new world and that eternal kingdom that shall have no end, instead of the kingdoms that rise and fall throughout human history. And God wants to make all things new. The Feast of Tabernacles will be humanity's transition point out of this world and into the world tomorrow. The fall season marks the beginning of the time when things do last and have eternal worth. All the prophets, apostles, and saints looked in their mind's eye to that time pictured by the Feast of Tabernacles, when the temporary of man's world will be replaced by the eternal, never-ending kingdom of God with us, members in that great kingdom and family. I'm just going to mention a few of them quickly to you. I'll mention Ecclesiastes excuse me, Hebrews 11, 13 through 16, it talks about those men and women of faith, our forefathers and foremothers of faith, who all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out of, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly kingdom. It's in heaven. When Christ is going to come to this earth, he's going to bring that kingdom and become King of Kings on this earth for those 1,000 years. Matthew 8, 36, Christ himself said, "What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? It's total vapor if he owned all wealth in the world, if any of us owned all the wealth in the world. It's a vapor that evaporates. What would you have accomplished if you could corner the wealth, as I said? And what would it profit you?" I'm just going to go to Philippians 3:8, where Paul said, "Yet indeed I also count all things loss for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish." Now that's a euphemism. King James says dung. "That I may gain Christ." 1 Corinthians 15:19. "If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most pitiable." If we're only holding this hope during this physical life, it is totally pitiable and futile. And Romans 8, 18 through 17 reminds us that everything that Paul experienced, including his sufferings, that he experienced, is not worthy to be compared with that eternal reward and the eternal things God has for us. Now I'm going to give one quick thing before concluding as a side note, just a side note. After that was the main message, but I just wanted to mention that a while back I shared with some people here that the keeping of the universal truth of Psalm 111:10 applies to every aspect of our life, including keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And that is, if we obey God, he will increase our understanding. And if we obey the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles, God promises to increase our understanding. And that has happened throughout history for those who obeyed the command to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The church started in 31 AD, keeping the annual holy days, including the Feast of Tabernacles. There were times when we don't have records of brethren keeping it, but they may be just off the radar of history. But we know that around 1800, many in the Church of God who strove to keep the commandments and had the name Church of God, they kept the name God has named his church, and strove to obey him with whatever knowledge they had. There was an awakening in the early 1800s of Church of God groups who wanted to start keeping the annual holy days. And there were men in the 1800s who were pioneers amidst the Church of God. They didn't have all the understanding, but they saw that God commanded it, and so they said, I'm going to do it. And this led up in the 1880s, actually, all the way up to 1927 by men such as Greenberry, Rupert, Clarence Dodd, and Andrew Duggar, and others, some of those whom Mr. Armstrong got to know. And they were starting to learn about the need to keep the Feast of Tabernacles and the other annual holy days. And then in 1927, Mr. Herbert Armstrong was baptized. And he read Leviticus 23, and he said to his wife, Mrs. Loma Armstrong, I don't know why, but God said to do this. And they kept it for 7 years alone, not knowing why or what it represented. And then he was preaching, and the door of radio technology opened up, and people were being called by his ministry. And in 1934, after 7 years of just Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong, 19 more, there were 19 people keeping the feast because of people who had heard his preaching, either in person or on radio. And then in 19, I misspoke. 7 years, and then they were alone. Then, starting in the seventh year, Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong kept it with others all the way to 1945. So now they weren't alone keeping it, but it wasn't until then that Mr. Armstrong, God gave to Mr. Armstrong the knowledge that the Feast of Tabernacles pictured the millennial reign of Jesus Christ on earth, and that it related to the things he had been reading in the book of Revelation. It took him 19 years, 7 plus 12, to get to 1945. All the time, Mr. Armstrong and then others just said, God says to do this, I will do it. And then God revealed more. And knowledge has continued to increase in the Church of God. And I read, and I believe this is true, that no other group but the true Church of God since that time of 1927, the world radio Church of God, Worldwide Church of God, the group, the brethren who, after those entities were no longer available, continued to carry the baton. No other group of people has proclaimed with all their being the second coming of Jesus Christ to rule on earth, on this physical earth, in the millennium, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. No other group has been as powerful as the true Church of God. Then through Mr. Armstrong, and then through us who've carried the baton afterwards. So this is very, very significant, very important for us. And it's very powerful that this has occurred and that we have a passion to proclaim the true gospel, which includes the millennium and not the false doctrine of going to heaven when one dies, because of groups and religions that do not keep God's feasts. Because of that, they don't know the truth. But those who do keep the Feast of Tabernacles have eventually been given that knowledge. And now it is our passion to proclaim that Christ's coming as King of Kings and Lord of Lords to rule this earth. And so, what better way could God use to prepare us now that the feast is over, now that we have heard the gospel about Christ's return to this earth and the many facets of his plan to this earth? What better way to prepare than to give us the Feast of Tabernacles and the Book of Ecclesiastes? So let us go on forward now, rejoice with sober rejoicing, doing the work after a wonderful feast that we just had.